Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, welcome everybody to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. This is Peter Schiff, president of Euro Pacific Capital, host of the show and author of Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. And I'm doing this show live at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, on my website at www.europac.net, and on shortwave radio at 5.07 megahertz. Only this time I'm doing it live at 5 p.m. I am in Las Vegas for the Vegas Money Show. And it brings back memories. When I first started this program, of course, I was working out of my Newport Beach office, and I always did the show at 5 o'clock. And when I moved out to the East Coast, I had to begin doing the shows at 8 o'clock in the evening. And I certainly prefer to do them at 5 o'clock. It was easier for me. That was one of the reasons I chose that time frame. But I've been doing them at 8 o'clock, and it's been working for me. But anyway, you know, the number to call toll-free if you have any questions or comments is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. If you're listening here from Las Vegas and you want to call and you want to mention anything of your experiences here at the Money Show, feel free to call in. That would be, I think, interesting. You know, I wrapped up all my presentations. Yesterday I did the bull bear debate. Joe Battipaglia, of course, was absent. He's no longer, I guess, a bull, to his credit. So they brought in another bull, Neil George. Oh, Louis Navalier was there again, and once again Louis seemed to lose control a little bit. I always seem to get under his skin. After the show, Louis and I exchanged some kind words. We talked for a while, and he seemed much nicer, and so we seem to get along behind the scenes more than he thinks. It's just that we never get along during the bull bear debates, which probably makes them more interesting anyway. So we did that, and I did my main show, and today I did another panel. We had our client-only meeting, or invitation-only meeting, which I think had close to 150 people. I think the last time we did it, we had fewer than 50. I think the first time I did one of these, we probably had 15 or 20. So, you know, when I started these meetings, I always would have the attendees introduce themselves, say a little bit about themselves. But now there are now so many people coming to the invitation-only event that we don't have time to do that. We would use up the entire 2 hours just in introductions. So we can see that our client base is growing and that my influence is certainly growing here, because more and more people are clients or our prospects are coming to hear me. And I just finished another debate this afternoon. I think Ned Reilly is the only panelist that comes to mind. You know, it was interesting too that Ned Reilly mentioned, and he's bullish. He's a bull on the market, and he's made the same argument on CNBC with me. He says that, the U.S. market has been one of the worst performing markets in the world, that it's way underperformed for the past 10 years, and therefore he wants to buy it because it must be cheap after years of outperformance. And I tried to point out that, he's got it half right. Yes, and he also admits that he's been in the U.S. market these past 10 years and that he's had lousy returns. And my point is, I haven't. I was able to anticipate the underperformance of the U.S. markets, and so we didn't have lousy returns because we invested abroad. And I said, if Ned, thinks the next 10 years are going to be better just because the last 10 years were bad, he doesn't understand the fundamentals. It's more likely that the next 10 years will be even worse than the 10 years that we just experienced as far as the U.S. relative to the rest of the world. So he's just assuming the trend is going to change. I assume the trend is going to stay the same, which I think is a better assumption to make. But You know, once again, at least I think I got some credit. I mean, Giffler, who moderated the Bull Bear debate, Charles Giffler, who runs the money shows, did acknowledge on many occasions that I have been right and that many of my predictions have come true. I always like that when at least they acknowledge that I've been right. Then, of course, they proceed to discredit everything that I say and ignore the fact that I've been right, and they continue to say the same stuff. But, you know, the most interesting thing about the Bull Bear debate, once again, is that both the bulls, both Louis Navalier and Neil George, for their investment recommendations, they're all exporters. They're all commodity stocks, agricultural stocks, stocks that are sensitive to inflation, stocks that benefit from the strengthening global economy. So even the bulls, you know, are not buying domestic demand type plays. They're not buying traditional U.S. companies. They're going abroad and buying inflation hedges. And they still can't see that even in their own investments, they're helping to prove my point that the U.S. is in trouble, that the economy is in trouble, that it's not rosy, and that salvation lies in foreign investments. You know, they're doing the same thing. Although one thing Louis Navalier said, you know, when somebody asked the question, why don't you buy foreign stocks? Why are you buying these domestic stocks? And he said that foreign stocks are too expensive. He says that you have to pay four times the PE, that foreign stocks are at 60 times earnings. And of course, I corrected Louis. I said, you know, Louis, this is ridiculous. I mean, there are some stocks, you know, in emerging markets that trade at 60 times earnings. But I said, you don't pay a premium to go abroad. I said, you get a discount. The stocks that we're buying trade at lower PEs than the 15 times that you're buying U.S. stock the market at. Plus, I think the U.S. PE is a fantasy, because I think a lot of the earnings are not going to materialize. So I think the U.S. market is a lot more expensive than Louis appreciates. But to think that the only way to invest abroad is to invest in emerging markets, you know, misses the fact that there's plenty of developed markets with mature companies that pay good dividends that are trading at discounts to what similar companies would trade for in the United States, despite the fact that they have better prospects for their earnings, and despite the fact that those earnings are coming in foreign currencies that are appreciating, as opposed to the U.S. dollar, which is depreciating and which will depreciate substantially based on what the Federal Reserve is doing. You know, in fact, look at the news, you know, again coming out today. You got, was it Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac announced, you know, big losses, but they weren't quite as big as people were anticipating based on some accounting. You know, they didn't take as big a write down as they should have. The losses are probably still there. Of course they're still there. They're just not acknowledging them. But the stock rallies when, of course, it should be going down. But the interesting thing about what we learned from Fannie or Freddie, whoever it was that in the last quarter, 81% of all the mortgages that were issued were guaranteed by one of these two entities. Now, as it stands now, they guarantee about half of our nation's mortgages. But now they are guaranteeing a far greater share than the huge share they already guarantee. Now, Fannie Mae, you know, they're trying to spin this as a positive, that they're gaining market share. Well, why would you want to gain market share in a lousy market? You know, the bigger your market share, the more you're going to lose. You know, the reason that they're gaining market share is because private companies without government guarantees won't touch these mortgages because they don't want to lose the money. But the federal government is encouraging Fannie and Freddie to be reckless just to try to, you know, postpone the pain from the bursting of the real estate bubble. But, you know, it's amazing that people would look at the fact that they have a greater share of a lousy market, that they have a greater share of future losses, is somehow attractive and is going to make me want to buy stock in these companies, because, of course, they also announced today that they're going to do a $5 billion offering of, I guess, some preferred stock because they need to raise capital to make up for all the money they're losing. And, you know, why would you want to invest? I mean, if a company comes to you and says, look, we're losing a fortune, we need you to invest in our company so we can cover these losses and make it to the next round of losses. I mean, I don't want to fund companies because they need my money to make up for their losses. I want to fund companies that are having profits but need additional money to expand and get even greater profits. What Freddie is saying is we need additional money so we can expand and have even bigger losses. This is nonsense, but this is what's going on. Hey, I'm checking at the board, and I noticed that there are no callers on hold, and I wonder if that means that nobody is calling, or is the screener forgetting to let me know the callers? Are there problems with the lines? Anyway, the number to call is 888- 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. It looks like apparently the lines might be free if anybody wants to call in. I'm trying to send an email now to see if that is in fact the case. Anyway, also, you know, in the government numbers today, once again, the U.S. government reported the CPI today, and the government told us that in CPI was only up 0.2% for the month, and that core prices were only up 0.1%. Hallelujah. You know, there's no inflation. According to the government, last month, gasoline prices dropped by 2%. Well, that's just fantastic. I'm so glad that gasoline prices went down by 2%. I mean, I just paid $4.50 to buy some gas. I didn't realize that the prices actually went down, so I'm glad for that. In fact, you know, it's funny. When I pulled into the gas station the other day, I was in a rush, and that particular station seemed a little bit pricey. So I asked the attendant for $10 worth, and I didn't even realize what I said. And then after the while, well, he starts pumping up, and I realize that all I'm getting is 2 gallons. You know, but I used to think, okay, $10 worth, you know, we get you half a tank, you get you plenty of gas, no problem, you can quickly grab $10 worth. Now it gets you $2. But, you know, the government said that gasoline prices were down last month, so I can take some comfort in that. I mean, this is all a bunch of nonsense, these government numbers. In fact, there was a story that came out that actually quoted me. I think I put it up in my website. Forget which paper ran it. But, you know, again, questioning government numbers both in unemployment and in inflation. And those are two numbers that I think are very disingenuous. And the other one, I think, is GDP. You know, I think GDP is a lot lower. The growth is, I think we're actually in a recession. And I think inflation and unemployment are both much higher than what the government admits. And, of course, you know, I don't know why everybody just takes this stuff on face value, just assumes the government has no agenda, they have no vested interest. But of course, politicians want to get reelected. And the way they get reelected is by telling you how good things are, telling you how much better the economy is now that they're in office than it was when somebody else was in office. And the way they can do that is with changing the way we calculate the numbers. So if they can say, look, when you elected me, you know, 5 years ago, unemployment was 7% and now it's 5%, then you can say that you reduced unemployment. But even if in order to do that, you've basically changed how you calculate it, and so maybe there's actually 9% unemployment if you still measured it the way you did when it was 7, but now with the new methodology, it's lower, and so you can campaign on having lowered unemployment when in fact unemployment has gone up. All that you've done is you've succeeded in changing the way you calculate it, so now that the result is a lower unemployment rate, but of course nobody reports it that way. And the same thing with inflation. You know, the government wants inflation not they want to understate inflation, they want to understate unemployment, and they want to overstate economic growth. So they do the opposite with the GDP numbers. And I just still can't believe how many people think it's crazy that the government would be dishonest. And again, you know, I've mentioned this before, they try to create a straw man by accusing me of saying there's some giant conspiracy to fudge these numbers. There is no conspiracy. They already changed the methodology. So the people at the, you know, the Department of Labor who are calculating these numbers, they're doing it exactly the way they were told to do it. And so these ridiculous numbers are exactly what the methodology does, because that's what the government designed it to do. The government didn't say, hey, let's find a way to count unemployment so it shows how much unemployment there is. Let's find a way to keep track of inflation so people will really know how much inflation we're creating. What they're saying is, how can we find a way to calculate inflation so that we can report a much lower rate of inflation than is actually the case, so we can fool the public into thinking that there's a lot less inflation than there really is? How can we calculate unemployment such that the unemployment rate is actually a lot lower than is the case, so people think that the economy is doing a lot better? And, of course, there's a number of reasons that they want to do that. I mentioned in the book, Crash Proof, they do it not only to fool the American electorate, but they do it to fool foreign creditors who are lending us all this money, who think that the U.S. economy is going to turn around. They want to keep giving out all this false news to the rest of the world, so they'll keep lending us money and buying our debt so we can keep this whole phony economy going. Anyway, I do notice that now there's a couple of callers coming on board. I don't know if they were here all along or he's just now typing them in. But the first caller is Mo calling from Michigan. Go ahead, Mo.
Yeah, I was calling initially to tell you that the volume of your radio show is really low, but now that's fixed. So that's been corrected. So, I also want to say I'm a huge fan, and I had a really quick question. Do you think that it's possible the Fed is trying to create all this inflation so that the banks can borrow, I mean, below the rate of inflation, and then actually invest in, say, energy and commodities to recapitalize themselves?
Well, they're not hoping that they invest in energy and commodities. I mean, they're trying to keep these banks afloat. They're hoping they'll continue to lend money to Americans to buy real estate and to buy other consumer goods they can't afford. The government is trying to socialize the losses through inflation so that hope that nobody notices them or that they can spread it out and diffuse the losses, and that somehow it's better to do it that way because the losses are there. And either the losses are going to be borne by the people who deserve to bear them, or they're going to be borne by everybody. And the government is opting for everybody. Just make everybody pay in the form of debased savings, in the form of higher food prices, higher energy prices, and a higher standard of living, a cost of living. Let's just take the losses through debasement of the currency. And in the meantime, you know, the government is able to also benefit because it's able to wipe out huge portions of its debt because, in effect, it's really defaulting on that debt because it's paying it back in cheaper money. So there are a lot of reasons why the government wants to create inflation, and they're hoping that the inflation will be able to bail us out. And, you know, the government then blames the results of their monetary policy, the rising prices. They blame it on external forces. They say it's happening because of food shortages, because of high economic growth, whatever we want to blame it on. Other than the fact that the higher prices are a direct consequence of the government policy to bail out Wall Street, that Main Street, that people who make $30,000 and $40,000 a year are being forced to pay higher prices for basic necessities so Wall Street, you know, billionaires can get bigger bonuses. I mean, that's what's going on here. And, of course, you know, why does the government favor Wall Street and bankers and financiers? Because that's where the money is. I mean, these guys are the biggest contributors to both political parties. The biggest contributors are the financial services industry. And so politicians are protecting their base, and their base is, you know, Wall Street billionaires and millionaires who finance their campaigns. And so even people who pretend to be champions of the poor and the downtrodden, what do? They make their lives more miserable by debasing the value of their labor, which is all they have, their wages, and forcing them into poverty and into more and more credit card debt. So that we can preserve the profits for Goldman Sachs and Citicorp and Morgan Stanley, or not even the profits, for the companies. We can preserve the bonuses and the salaries for the executives. Because the actual owners of these companies, the shareholders, they're getting screwed. Right? And in fact, the weird thing is, the big executives are using stockholders' money to make political contributions, yet their shareholders are getting shafted because all the profits, or in many cases their losses, all the revenues are all accruing to the guys who are running the company, who are making all these bad bets that are bankrupting their companies, but they're getting rich because the Federal Reserve is bailing them out, or attempting to anyway.
I mean, I agree with you completely, but what I'm saying is that in order to keep them in nominal terms solvent, they know that they're creating inflation, and then they say they're not, but the real plan is that the banks can actually invest in, you know, commodities and actually, like, in nominal terms. I understand the losses are going to be
banks are
socializing
commodities. That's just going to put more pressure on these commodities. You know, I mean, they're hoping to artificially levitate home prices. They're thinking, gee, we got to stop home prices from collapsing. So if we just create enough inflation, we can keep home prices up. But it's not going to work. I mean, home prices have to fall. And if they're just going to try to, prevent them from falling, they're just going to make the price of everything else go up. And so maybe in nominal terms they won't fall, but in real terms they'll fall even more. And, of course, the problem is the government can create a lot of inflation, but wages rise a lot more slowly than prices, especially since so much of the products that we produce are imported. So I think the wages are not going to keep up with it. In fact, I think the wages in the service sector are going to be falling. So if the government is creating more inflation and debasing our money, even though housing prices might not be falling as much, wages are falling, and so houses are not becoming more affordable. In order for inflation to make homes more affordable, it also has to cause individual Americans to have higher incomes, and then they can take those higher nominal incomes and afford more expensive houses. But if we're not getting the income growth, if the inflation is causing food and energy prices to rise, but it's not necessarily forcing wages and salaries to rise, then houses become less affordable as a result of inflation, not more affordable. So it's the exact opposite of what the government is hoping to achieve.
Well, yeah, I mean, I understand that, but even with house prices nominally decreasing, but couldn't they just have like a biflation kind of scenario where in a triage situation, wouldn't the Bernanke be trying to preserve the bank's solvency primarily and, you know, screw Joe Sixpack?
Well, they are trying to do that. That's why they're buying up all the worthless paper on the books of these investment banks and commercial banks. They're buying subprime mortgages or mortgages. They're buying credit card debt, student loans, auto loans, loans that are worth a fraction of what the government is paying for them. And, you know, they're accumulating hundreds of billions of dollars worth of this paper to keep these firms from going the way of Bear Stearns. I mean, Bear Stearns was the one sacrificial lamb, and now they're saying nobody else. And, you know, it is a disaster, and this is the reason why prices are rising and why they're going to keep rising and why the government right now has also basically shown its hand. Its hand is inflation. We're going down this direction. I don't think we're going to veer from it anytime soon. The government is committed to this tactic, and it's going to be a complete disaster. Anyway, thanks for the call. Let me take a quick break. I'll play a commercial. We'll be back for more calls on the other side of the break.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we are back. You know, I'm just looking at my emails, and I've got like three or four emails from people saying they're having a hard time hearing the show. It's not working. Obviously, if you can't hear the show, you can't hear me. Now, but if you can hear the show and you're one of the people who sent me an email that said you were having trouble, let me know if that's changed, because I know one person said on the air that the volume was low and that now it's picked up. So I don't know why I've got these emails, but if anybody who was having problems before, if that's resolved, then obviously, you know, you can only respond if you're listening, which means it has resolved. Just let me know that the problem has cleared up. Anyway, let me go back to the phones. Let me see, the next guy on hold is Mike in Ohio. Go ahead, Mike. Is Mike there? All right, well, I can't. What about Sergio in Florida?
Yeah, I'm here, Peter. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Great. Just to let you know, yeah, the first 15 minutes, the volume was coming in really low, but we could hear you pretty good now.
No, I don't know. I wonder what the problem was.
Well, I'm not sure. It's something out of your server problem. Peter, I met you down here in Boca Raton at your last meeting. It was a pleasure meeting you. Read your book. Found it fantastic. Just wanted to let you know I'm a real estate appraiser and a broker down here in Key Biscayne, South Florida. And the market down here, is, I'm sure you've heard, is really taking a tumble.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to get to a question. I remember you mentioning that basically that the realtors were telling the buyers that the properties were to continue to appreciate. And that was the case through, like, summer of 06, I found out to be. But after that, I noticed, especially appraising properties down at a Lennar project specifically, I noticed there was a lot of product coming on the market, but obviously it was more than, you know, they were, like, overbuilding. And I was beginning to tell the banks that the prices were starting to decline and drop And I noticed that something they didn't want to hear. I guess they wanted to keep the perpetual rising.
You know, I was on television, you know, a year ago saying that home prices would fall 20 to 30% nationwide and 50% in the bubble markets. People thought that was crazy. It could never happen. But, of course, that's exactly what is happening or has happened in some cases. And, yeah, when they were reporting that prices were still rising, that was fantasy because there were very few transactions. Meanwhile, inventories were building, and, you know, they were, you know, it was all a fantasy of the types of properties that were selling. It was all skewed. But we know prices are going to collapse because prices were up at ridiculous bubble levels as a result of the unprecedented amount of speculation being driven by all the credit that was flowing into the real estate market that is no longer flowing there because so much money has been lost lending to real estate.
Right. Well, Peter, I remember Ross Perot, good old Ross, mentioning always if you want to find out what's happening, follow the money. If we follow the money in this case, where do you think this problem originated from? Was it the rating agencies, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, Fitch, giving AAA ratings, these junk bonds, and basically, you know, Wall Street selling that to the Chinese, the Arabs, all over the world, and basically we all found out it was a house of cards and people started turning their keys in and walking away from properties?
Mm-hmm.
If you were to guess, where would you say the subprime mess started?
Well, I mean, we know. I wrote about it in my book. I've been talking about how it started. I mean, the subprime started because, you know, Wall Street found a way to let people buy homes that nobody would want to lend money to. I mean, they couldn't, you know, they couldn't borrow money from traditional sources. So Wall Street said, hey, here's a pool. Here's some business we should go after. High-risk borrowers who can't afford to repay their loans. But they figured that they just bought enough of these things and packaged them up that they could create AAA paper out of a bunch of junk. And they got the credit agencies to go along with them. And because you had all these hedge funds that were looking for higher yields and a lot of leverage, I mean, they found buyers and people were willing to look the other way because it was somebody else's money. But, of course, the real root of the problem is the Fed. If the Fed had not provided all this cheap money to Wall Street, then the subprime market never could have come into existence. Teaser rates, which were a hallmark of the whole subprime lending, the whole idea was since people couldn't afford their mortgages, you'd have to give them a teaser rate that they could afford. And so they would have a rate for the first 2 or 3 years that was in their reach, but that ultimately was out of their reach. But when they valued the assets, they assumed that the payments would be made based on the entirety of the loan. So when they valued the bond, even though the first 3 years the interest rate was 6%, for the next 27 years the rate was 10%, they assumed basically that 10% was going to be paid, even though they would have known going in that it was impossible because the borrowers didn't have that much money. But the only reason they were able to do the teaser rate was because the Fed had the Fed funds rate down at 1%. So it all made sense. If it wasn't for Alan Greenspan, none of this would have ever happened.
And Bernanke's continuing to say what?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's following in his footsteps, and he's making the same mistakes. And, you know, it's going to be a disaster. I mean, that's why we're doing what we're doing. That's why we're helping people get their money out of the dollar, because the dollar is going to be the casualty. You know, the losses are going to be spread among people who hold U.S. currency. Anyway, thanks for the call. I got a number of people on hold.
You're welcome. Take care.
All right. Next call, I guess, I don't know if Mike is back on the line from Ohio.
No, I'm Jim from Las Vegas.
Okay, well, you're the next. So I guess we lost Mike, so let's take Jim from Las Vegas. How are you, Jim? Are you here at the Money Show?
Yeah, I just left you an hour ago. I told you I was going to go home and listen to your show. And
all right, well, you did.
Yeah.
Hear the first 15 minutes, or was it low for you, too?
I didn't have any sound for first 15 minutes.
That's terrible. I said some good stuff during those first 15 minutes.
Sorry, I didn't get to hear it. I wanted to know your opinion on soft commodities, wheat, you know, corn. I didn't get any, you know, you were talking about commodities, but, you know, we're running out of food. What about sugar and, you know, and wheat and corn, soybeans?
Running out of food, we're just printing too much money. And so people have more money to buy food. You know, that's the problem. It's not a shortage of food. It's a surplus of money. That's the problem.
Okay. No, I didn't realize that.
It wants you to think it's a food shortage because that takes them off the hook.
No. Well, that's what they're trying to tell us, that there's a food shortage. So you think the soft commodities are not going to be a good investment tool?
No, we own commodities. I think commodity prices are going to rise as a function of inflation, and so it's a way to store wealth. You know, in fact, I've even told people, apart from investing, it makes sense to stock up individually. You know, if you have a big pantry, fill it up. You know, don't do grocery shopping for a week. Do it for a month. Do it for a year if you can. You know, buy things that won't go bad. You know, when you go to the drugstore to buy toiletries, don't just buy one can of shaving cream. Buy a dozen. Buy a couple of years worth of razor blades. They don't take up a lot of room. You know, buy a lot of these things because you know what? They're all going to get more expensive. You know, and so why put the money in the bank and just pay 20 or 30% more for the products next year that you can buy this year? So, in all aspects, I think you want to buy the stuff you're going to need. You know, don't wait for it to be more expensive. But it's opposite for things like houses. Houses are going to get cheaper. And, you know, a lot of people here at the Money Show, they try to claim that, well, one of the reasons that inflation isn't bad is because home prices are falling, and that's counteracting it. But that's nonsense. And home prices represent an asset, and the fact that home prices are falling, what you really have to look at is the cost of home ownership, and that is going up. The cost of buying a home, you need a bigger down payment. You have higher mortgage payments. Your taxes are higher. Your insurance costs are higher. Your maintenance costs are higher. The fact is housing is becoming less affordable despite the fact that prices are falling.
Yeah.
In fact, falling prices makes housing more expensive because now the asset that you're buying is depreciating, and the depreciation is another expense.
Well, no, I fully agree with you. I'm 100% behind you there, and I also appreciate your knowledge on investing in foreign stocks with paid dividends. So your company will definitely be hearing from you, and I thank you very much.
Okay, great. Look forward to your business.
Thank you, Peter.
And I just found out, too, that it was about the first 8 minutes that the sound was down, and they had a fix. I don't know what went wrong, but what's going to happen is it's not going to affect the archive. So if you want to hear the first 8 minutes of the show, if you missed it, if you wait till later on today or tomorrow, whenever we post this on the website, you can listen to the archive version and you can hear the first 8 minutes and you can get whatever it is that you missed. And once again, I apologize for it. I don't know what happened or, you know, how we can prevent it in the future, but at least it's good to know that the 8 minutes is not lost. It's there and you can listen to it whenever you want. Anyway, the next caller is Trisha from Dallas.
Hi there. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask a couple of quick questions. I'm kind of new at investing, and I don't have a lot of money to work with. I've done some work overseas and mission work and stuff, so I haven't really saved much. But I've kind of gotten into the stock market and dabbling into it and finding about these ADRs, and I'm kind of looking at this stock called Vision China Media, and it seems to have been steadily increasing. But, you know, then I started reading some of the things on your website, you know, being careful, you know, that you're not really getting the full benefit of these stocks because of the Wall Street, you know, group there. And I know you do it differently. You go directly to the exchanges, right, instead of going, you know, through Wall Street. But I'm trying to find out, is that something that you would recommend for a person who doesn't have a lot of money, say less than $10,000? And also, or would you just say invest in gold?
Yeah, I like gold. I think people should own gold. I mean, people can buy some ADRs, I mean, if they're the right companies. I mean, there are some of the companies that are on my recommended list that actually have ADRs, and so you can buy the ADRs. But in most cases, most of the stocks that we like don't have them. You know, and if you only have $10,000 to invest, it is difficult to really good diversified portfolio. But you can buy a little gold. I mean, maybe we can put you can even buy a couple of funds or exchange-traded funds that they're not ideal, but when you're working with a small amount of money, or, you know, we can buy you one or two stocks that are pretty conservative.
Well, and I talked to one of your brokers. He was very nice, and I'm going to keep in touch with him and talk to him. But what about the GLD and the SLV on the
Yeah, I mean, you can buy them, those exchange-traded funds, for gold and silver. I mean, as long as, you know, there's no fraud there, if the gold and silver is really there and there's no accounting fraud, then, you know, but the risk you run is that, you know, that there is a problem, that they don't have as much gold as they claim, and at some point that comes out, and then they drop. If they find out that they overstated the amount of gold by 20%, then the stock, they would go down by 20% because they wouldn't have an ounce of gold, you know, per share, whatever the ratio is, or 10 ounces per share, whatever it is.
Okay, that's what I was concerned about because, you know, when you don't have a lot, you want to, you know, conserve what you have, and so I don't want to get any poorer than I am. But thanks so much for taking the call. I listen to you all the time, and you're really good advice, and I believe everything you're saying. I just want to make sure I kind of do something to protect myself.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, thanks so much. Okay, bye-bye.
Sure. Thanks for calling and for the feedback. Let's take a call from Mike in Virginia.
Hey, Peter. How you doing tonight?
Good, good. How are you?
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I had a couple questions related to the housing crisis and the credit crisis and sort of where we are. We're hearing sort of rumblings now out of Wall Street. Folks are saying, well, you know, the worst of the write-downs is over, that sort of thing. I would tend to hypothesize that the worst of the write-downs isn't really going to be over until the housing prices actually all adjust and come down. So I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, of course. Look, the write-downs have barely just begun. We've got the tip of a huge iceberg here. This is all wishful thinking. The guys that are saying that the worst of the write-downs are over are the same guys that said that the problems were contained into subprime. They were the same guys that were saying that there was no problem. They're the same guys that were saying there was no real estate bubble. The guys that are saying this have been the same people who have been consistently wrong about everything they've ever said. So I discount what they say, you know, immediately. I don't even know if it's legitimate forecasting. It's just they're saying what they want people to hear. It's in the interest of the government. It's in the interest of Wall Street for people to believe that the worst is behind us. So that's what they say.
And then
they're never going to say the worst is in front of us.
And then in that same vein, I know there were a lot of interesting things that came out of the Freddie conference call today, and I just wanted to see if you had a chance to.
No, I didn't listen to it.
That and have any idea. You may want to. I think you'd find it interesting.
Yeah, look, I know they're trying to claim great opportunity here to increase their market share, and as I said earlier in the show, I mean, this is not a good thing. I mean, I don't want a greater market share of a disaster. I don't want to, you know, I mean, because what you're going to do is lose money. The bigger your share in the mortgage market, the more money you're going to lose. I mean, nothing attractive about that.
I think you'd also see some interesting accounting that they seem to be doing this quarter, or at least for this last quarter. So
all smoke and mirrors, and we know that. Look, the government is willing to do anything they can to cover this up. The last thing the government wants is for financial institutions to be forthright, to tell people the truth. They just want to lie. All the politicians care about is there's an election coming up. How do we get reelected? And we get reelected by lying. We get reelected by pretending that the problems are solved. We don't get reelected by telling the truth about how bad things are going to be and that we can't do anything to fix it. And so, and the problem is whenever there's election, you know what? Then there's another election coming up. So that's all they ever care about is how can we get to the next election, which is always around the corner. So what can we do? How can we cover it up? How can we push it off? How can we postpone it? You know, and they don't care how bad they make it. But, you know, individuals, you know, I care. I care about my money. I care about my clients' monies. You care about your own money. So we're not politicians. We need our money to be there in the long run. We don't care about these guys' short-term political careers. So we've got to take action now and recognize that all we're going to get from the government, all we're going to get from Wall Street is a bunch of nonsense.
Well, Peter, I appreciate you taking the call and wish you a good night.
Hey, thanks for calling. Next caller on hold is Mark in California.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, thanks. Hey, I loved Crash Proof, and I'm looking forward to the new book coming out soon. Mm-hmm. I had a question for you about the CPI numbers and whatnot, the three-card Monty game that the government keeps playing with these figures.
Did you hear? I talked about them a little bit earlier in the show. Did you hear that?
You know what? I missed the beginning, like everybody else, the first 10 minutes or so. I thought I wasn't going to be able to hear you this week.
Well, again, as I said, I check back later in the day or tomorrow so you can hear those missing 8 minutes.
All right. Hey, I was curious to get your thoughts on another sort of aspect of inflation, and that's something called hidden inflation. Well, the government hides inflation to begin with their phony numbers, but hidden inflation where companies will take a product and, cut the quantity that they're putting in each serving or each bag. And
theoretically, the government is supposed to adjust for that, right? They use hedonics. They say that, you know, when the quality improves, that they reduce the price, you know, but I wonder if it works in reverse. If they reduce the amount of cereal in a box. I mean, I remember when I used to buy a box of cereal when we were a little kid. I mean, it was something, I always wanted to buy the cereal with the prize inside. And, you know, we would buy a box of cereal, and my mother would bring it home, and the first thing we would do is open up the cereal and pour the contents into big bowls so I can get the prize. Because the cereal went all the way to the top, and there's no way to dig your way down there. Now I buy my son cereal, and I open it up, and the prize is right there because the cereal starts two-thirds of the way down. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to look around. I don't have to puff up the box. I mean, I think I bought one box of cereal. I think we each had two bowls and it was finished. But I mean, there's all this stuff. I mean, there's a lot of things now that you buy that are in pieces that you used to buy fully assembled. So let's say there's an office chair that I used to buy for $100 and it was all set. You know, now I buy the same chair. Maybe it's even $90. Maybe the government says it went down, but it takes me 2 hours to assemble it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things. There's all the time we spend waiting on hold that, that we used to. Look at the airlines. I mean, look at the big reduction in the quality. You think the government is factoring in the loss of meals, the loss of being able to carry on luggage and check baggage and all the other charges and all the other income. You think the government is factoring in? I used to go to the airport. And I used to arrive, 10, 15 minutes before the flight. I used to run through the airport, like the O.J. Simpson commercials, and I used to walk through the door right as it was shutting. You can't do that anymore. You got to be at the airport a couple hours in advance. What's all that time worth? There's so much of the cost of living going up that isn't getting captured by the government numbers.
Yeah, I agree. And also on the inflation front, they're CNBC once again today. Kudlow had a group on there singing the bull market has returned song. What is your opinion about the $125 a barrel for oil and how that's going to spread throughout the economy as we head?
First of all these guys on Kudlow that say the bull market has returned, as far as they were concerned, it never ended. I mean, it's been a bull market the whole time, so this is all nonsense. It's not like they said, hey, the market's going to go down, get out. They said everything is great. They're still talking Goldilocks. They were talking a Goldilocks economy on the verge of the biggest collapse in our history, basically, since they've been on television, and they thought it was a paradise. They thought it was a fantasy fairy tale, So you're not going to get anything out of these guys. They're all a bunch of hype. I mean, once in a while, John Brown comes on from Euro Pacific, and, he tries to set them straight as best he can. But even he has to tone it down because he doesn't want to suffer the same fate as me. I used to be on that show a lot. Then they cut me out of the lineup. And I think they cut me out of the lineup because, they didn't like what I was saying, despite the fact that everything I was saying came true. And all the people that were on the show that were wrong, well, they keep inviting them back because they like what they're saying. So it's okay to be bullish and wrong. They don't want you to be bearish and right. Although there are a few people that they have on there that have been semi-bearish on a few things, and they still invite them back. So I guess I was just too bearish for them.
Yeah. Well, you're speaking the truth, so that they didn't want that. Hey, I really enjoy reading Crash Proof. I've read it many times. And could you give us a preview on the new book and when it's coming out?
Well, the new book, I'm still not sure. It could come out as early as October. And maybe as late as January or February. I know the publishers really want to get it out in October. For me, I just assume have it come out later and have more time on it. I guess I'm just very busy, but, they want to get it out. They think there's a lot of demand for it right now, and, of course, they're probably right, there is. But it's going to be a little bit, it's going to be a little bit different than Crash Proof. I'm going to try to get as much of the big picture stuff in there as I can, but the publishers want to make it more of a how-to book, and a lot of the audience, the little book audience is much different from the Crash Proof audience. If you look at the people who have read Crash Proof, they've read all the other gloom and doom books. They read all the books from Agora and all the other books about coming demise and coming collapse and you name it. But if you look at all the little book series, they don't read any of those books. I mean, they read a lot of mainstream stuff. They read a lot of Kramer's books and stuff like that. So, it's going to go into a different audience and it's a different, format. But it'll be an interesting book. There'll be some new stuff in there, and it'll definitely be worth the read. It's going to be a short book because these little books are shorter, so it might be half the size of Crash Proof because that's the whole formula for the little book. So,
yeah.
And again, it's going to be the little book of bull moves and bear markets. How to keep your portfolio up when the markets are down.
Great. I look forward to reading it. Hey, well, you must be making headway with your message because there's an article on Bloomberg tonight that says wealthy say it's time to get back in stocks. Wealthy are interested in energy and Asia. That's the article.
Well, that's what they should be interested in.
Yeah, I agree. That's your message, yeah. Okay, thanks again, Peter, for everything. I look forward to reading the new book.
All right, thanks for the call. Yeah, the number to call, I still probably have time for one or two additional callers, maybe one. It's 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. And do I have Kevin online from California? Oh, actually, I think Kevin might have dropped off. I just got a note. So I think the lines are clear right now. So if anybody wants to call, they would be the next to be on, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. You know, it's amazing, too, the last caller asked about, you know, $125 oil. I mean, how the mainstream media has now somehow embraced the idea that $125 barrel oil is okay, that it's not, you know, any kind of problem, and it doesn't reflect the problem. They seem to think that even if oil goes to $200 a barrel, which is what Goldman Sachs said could happen, that even that's okay. And, you know, it's not okay. I mean, they look at the economy, and they say, well, the economy is still functioning with $125 oil. It's functioning, but it's functioning with more debt. Where are people getting money to pay $4 a gallon for gas? They're getting it by borrowing it. They're borrowing it from the Chinese. So we're going into debt to afford this oil. This doesn't mean that it's not doing any damage. What it means is that we're postponing the damage. And in fact, higher oil prices are doing even more damage than if Americans were paying for the higher oil with cash. Because now not only do we have to pay for the oil, but we have to pay the interest on the money we borrowed to buy the oil. So this is really a disaster, and if people think that high oil prices are okay, as long as we can borrow the money to pay it, you know, that's the same logic that fed the real estate boom or the dot-com boom. It's going to lead to disaster. You know, people just can't look at the surface. They've got to at least look, you know, a layer below to see what's really happening and to see the consequences of what's going on. And I also think one of the reasons that a lot of Americans haven't dramatically reduced their gasoline consumption, despite higher prices, is because they are putting it on a credit card. And so they're not really having to deal with these high prices. They're putting the pain off into the future because they're simply borrowing the money to maintain their level of consumption. And so it is doing damage. It's doing a tremendous amount of damage. It's just that most people on Wall Street are just not able to figure it out. You know, they're just completely clueless. I mean, and I hear people say, well, you know, as long as OPEC takes the money they earn from buying our dollar or selling us oil and they reinvest it back in our country, then it doesn't hurt us. Well, of course it hurts us because we're trading oil for assets. We're trading oil for income-producing assets, or we're going deeper into debt. And we're accumulating liabilities as our trading partners accumulate assets. To think that it's okay as long as we can go into debt to buy it is complete nonsense because we're bankrupting ourselves. And certainly the higher oil prices go and food prices, and again, you know, I think the next major category of goods that are really going to take a move up is going to be apparel. And so I think maybe, you know, the government's going to have to talk about the CPI, ex-food, ex-energy, and ex-apparel. You know, they already kind of do it ex-rents. You know, they try to say, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that we're not going to see substantial increase because, you know, all the apparel, of course, it's all imported, all the textiles, 100% of it is imported. And, you know, the cotton and just the raw materials and the energy, the cost of making it, and the labor. You know, a lot of the peasants that are working, their labor, the wages are rising because they need higher wages to pay for more expensive food. So I got to believe the next major increase in a broad category of consumer goods, other than like airfares, which are already going up and they're going to go a lot higher, is going to be clothing. And so then we're going to have big increases in all the basic necessities, you know, food, energy, and clothing. And the government will still maintain that there's no inflation. Anyway, I got two callers on hold, so let's make these the last two callers. Let's take Kevin from California, who I understand is back on.
Oh, yes, I'm here. Peter, I was just curious. I just read A Bull in China by Jim Rogers, and I understand that he's an intellectual ally of yours, and I know that you guys see eye to eye on many issues. And I was just wondering, I see that you sell the Rogers Index, and I was just wondering if some of the stocks that he mentions in the book, A Bull in China, you're going to be recommending to your clients?
You know, we know about those stocks, and there are some of them that we might like and we might recommend. We can certainly buy anybody any of those stocks if they can't get them from other brokers and would just like to buy some of the Rogers stocks. We don't really sell the Rogers Index. We had to make that change to our website. We were selling the Rogers Fund, and it's been shut down for a couple of years, and so we've been waiting for it to reopen. So we had to take down some of that language for compliance purposes. But you know, we're still waiting for the fund to reopen, and we're hoping to be able to sell the Rogers Fund again because we used to sell a lot of it, and it's done very well. But it got caught up in that Repco mess, and they had to close it to new investors, and it's been closed for a long time.
Right. But I just, out of curiosity, I was wondering when your Pacific Capital is going to be suggesting for its clients more stocks in Hong Kong. I see that you guys are suggesting right now a lot of energy plays in Hong Kong and elsewhere.
We've got a lot of Hong Kong stocks. I mean, I'd say the typical portfolio that we're coming up with right now, you know, maybe about a third of the money is going into Hong Kong and Singapore. I mean, we're and Japan. So we're heavily weighting Asia right now, and you know, it's so we're there, and we're getting a lot of exposure, you know, to the markets there, and getting a lot of exposure to China and Southeast Asia through those markets. And so, if you don't have enough Singapore stocks or Hong Kong stocks in your portfolio, or you don't have anything in Japan, just call the broker up and make sure that we, you know, that the next time you add money, that's the area that we focus on.
Oh, okay, just you know, to try and push them into one focus or another, if. That's what you.
No, it should be. So I'm saying if you have an account with me now and it's mostly resources, it's mostly Australia, Canada, you know, what you got to do is, you know, you got to make sure that you get some more diversification. You've probably done well with those resource stocks, but yeah, you don't want to overlook some of the other areas that we invest in.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. And let's take the last call for this evening is coming from Al in Boston. Go ahead, Al.
How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Peter, you know, I read your book, and I've been listening to you for about a year and a half now. And, you know, when Bear Stearns started to unravel, I was traveling at that time, and I just panicked, and I just said, I've got to get everything out of the dollar, everything into gold, silver, energy stocks, foreign currencies. And I did, you know, and since that top, and since Bernanke stepped in, it's been a little bit painful. And I guess I'm calling because I don't want to jump off, you know, the building here and get out of these holdings. But
no, well, I don't know what you bought. But I mean, remember, most of the foreign stocks have also recovered. Now, gold might have pulled back a little bit. Maybe you kind of bought, you know, a short-term peak in some of the gold stocks or in the metal. But if you bought foreign stocks and you bought them through me, they're all way up since those Bernanke lows. So you should be doing fine in foreign stocks other than, you know, maybe some of the metal stocks that might have taken a bigger hit. But no, I mean, I think you've done the right thing. I mean, timing, I mean, sometimes when you act on an emotional element, when a lot of other people are acting, from a timing point of view, you probably didn't make the most strategic shift. You should have done it sooner or maybe waited a little bit, but it's done. You're certainly better off where you are now than where you were. And so I wouldn't worry about what happens in the short run. You're investing for the bigger picture because you understand. I mean, are you working with us or another firm?
Actually, no, I'm not working with your firm right now, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, what you should do is contact one of my brokers and, you know, let us know what you've got. I mean, say, you know, here's what I've already bought, and if we think that, you know, everything is fine, then you can stay the course. If we think that maybe there's something that you can add to what you're doing or a slight change you can make, then maybe we can help you make it. But I certainly wouldn't panic. I wouldn't rush to sell anything just yet. And chances are the bulk of what you have you should keep. But there might be along the edges, there might be some value that we can add and some things that we might be able to help you do that you haven't done.
Yeah, I guess what I look at is I don't see any connection anymore right now between gold and oil or gold and the value of the...
There is. I mean, in the short run, yeah, I mean, oil has continued to rise and gold has pulled back, and I think that's an excellent opportunity to buy gold. I think gold is as cheap as it's been in years relative to oil, and I think that generally the relationship will hold, and I think it's going to be resolved not with oil prices falling but with gold prices rising.
Yeah, because there's definitely another group of people out there just pound the table that the, you know, dollar's back, our imbalances don't matter, nobody wants
the same. But these are the same clowns who were saying everything was great all along. These are the same people that said there was no housing bubble, that said everything was perfect. So you can't believe what they say. They've never gotten it right in the past, and they've always had an agenda, and that's their agenda, telling you how great it is. You know, and that's what they're doing. And
yeah, I get,
you know.
Is there enough leverage, though, in the world to say, we don't want to see the dollar crash, we don't want to see this unravel, because, you know, ultimately it's...
No, they can't. I mean, because all they can do is debase their own money, and it creates even bigger problems, and it allows our imbalances to continue to grow. And so there's no way out of it. I mean, I think we're at the point now where foreigners are starting to appreciate that propping us up is more expensive than letting us collapse. And therefore, they'd rather take the lesser of the two, which is allow us to collapse and bite the bullet rather than having to bite a much bigger bullet down the line.
Yeah, you know what, Peter? I have listened to you and I've read your book and I've been following you for a long time, and I travel internationally heavily. And I just got to say that, you know, we're the biggest. It's like we went into every port. We used credit cards. We charged up everything. We bought everything, threw it back on the boat, and then we had them finance it as we drove off or sailed away. And ultimately, you got to pay for that. It just seems to me like...
We can't pay for it. You know, the people who are going to pay for it are the lenders who loaned us the money, the people who own U.S. dollars. Americans bought products that they can't afford. They'll never afford it. That's the problem. You know, it's the Chinese who should have been buying these products. They're the ones that produced them. They're the ones that can legitimately afford it. But they didn't. They loaned us their money. You know, the savings rate in China is over 50% now. And what are they doing with their savings? They're loaning it to us. And then what are we doing with the savings? We're buying all the products that they're doing without. And as I mentioned in my show today, it's not like the Chinese don't want these products. It's not like the Chinese enjoy, you know, washing their dishes by hand and washing their clothes in a laundry drum in the backyard. They would rather have, you know, washer dryers and dishwashers, but they can't afford them because the government is suppressing the value of their currency, or they're denying it to themselves because they're saving the money instead of spending it on a washer dryer. And so the Americans are buying the washer dryers instead. And all they have to do is reclaim their own purchasing power, and their economies will thrive, and their standard of living will rise, ours will drop like a stone, because, you know, they'll kick us off the global gravy train.
Yeah, the way I see it is that no one really wants to see the U.S. dollar collapse. They don't want to see this $13 trillion
I don't care. Nobody wanted, people didn't want housing prices to come down. People didn't want .com prices to come down, but it happened anyway. I don't care what people want. I know what's reality. I mean, I don't want to die. I know I'm going to die someday. I don't want to, but it's going to happen. There's nothing you can't just say, well, we don't want it to happen, therefore it's not going to happen. I didn't want to get old. I didn't want my hairline to recede. I didn't want to have some extra weight around my stomach, but, you know, it happened. I guess I could have prevented that. I could exercise more, but, you know, a lot of things happen that people don't want. But the reality is, though, a lot of people around the world don't understand that they'd actually be better off if the dollar were to fall in value. It's like if you were going to go to an auction, you know, and you went to an auction and you wanted to buy things, and the other people that came to the auction, all of a sudden they lost a lot of money, you'd be better off because now, you know, you'd be able to buy more stuff because you'd have less competition. Fewer people would be outbidding you for the things that you wanted. I mean, the last thing you want is to go to the auction and everybody else is richer than you and everybody else has more purchasing power. You're not going to be able to buy anything. So if the dollar collapses, you know, the Chinese are better off because they can buy more stuff. I mean, there's only X amount of stuff produced every year. There's not an unlimited amount of stuff. And who gets it? Well, who can pay the most? And if the dollar collapses, then the Americans can't pay the most. Maybe the Chinese can pay the most. And so they'll be able to buy a lot of products that right now they can't afford. And it's Americans who will do without the product. So why is China worse off? Why are they worse off if they get more stuff? You know, I think they're better off. And they're going to figure it out, too.
Yeah, I travel there frequently. I can say that, you know, they look at the U.S. as their engine of growth, too. Just like, you know, that's our manufacturing base. But without us buying all their stuff, they're worried. They're concerned about that. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, they shouldn't be because, you know, everybody needs demand. Everybody has unlimited demand. The key in an economy is production. Everybody wants things. There is unlimited demand by definition in economics. The key is supply. The key is to produce stuff. And production creates its own demand, and as long as the Chinese can produce, that's the entire ballgame. You know, it's we're the ones that are in trouble. Anyway, thanks a lot for the call. I'm running out of time here. I'm in my last minute. Hey, someone called in, wanted to know if the Money Show stuff will be on YouTube. I don't think so. My presentations were not taped, so if they're not video recorded, they can't be on YouTube. Some of the panel discussions might have been taped, and so at some point they might make it on YouTube, although I don't think they'll be there in the immediate future, although some of them might be up on the Money Show website. You can take a look. But my individual meetings and my client-only meetings are certainly not going to be up on YouTube. There is one Money Show seminar I did on YouTube now from a couple years ago. You can look at that one. There's one of the Bull Bear debates from a couple years ago. That's also on YouTube. Anyway, thanks again for calling. Don't forget to buy the book, Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. Call my office to open up an account to talk with a broker, 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922. I will be back again next week at the same time. I should be back in Connecticut. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And once again, I appreciate the audience and all the people who came to Las Vegas for the Money Show. Thanks. Bye-bye.